could make head or tail of them I do not know, for they are very mysterious and hard to grasp. Their meaning is roughly this. In all the world, in wind and rain, in plants and animals, in the passage from day to night, in the movements of the stars, everything acts in accordance with one great law. This he calls the Tao, which means the way or the path. Only man in his restless striving, in his many plans and projects, even in his prayers and sacrifices, resists, as it were, this law, obstructs its path, and prevents its fulfilment. Therefore, the one thing we must do, said Lao Tzu, is do nothing. Be still within ourselves. Neither look nor listen to anything around us. Have no wishes or opinions. Only when a person has become like a tree or a flower, empty of all will or purpose, will he begin to feel the Tao, that great universal law which makes the heavens turn and brings the spring, begin to work within him. This teaching, as you see, is hard to grasp, and harder still to follow. Perhaps, in the solitude of the distant mountains, Lao Tzu was able to take doing nothing so far that the law began to work within him in the way he described. But maybe it is just as well that it was Confucius and not Lao Tzu who became the great teacher of his people. What do you think? Chapter 12. The Greatest Adventure of All. Greece's age of splendor was short-lived. The Greeks could do everything but live in peace with one another. Above all, it was Athens and Sparta who could not put up with one another for long. By 430 BC, the two states were locked in a long and bitter conflict. This was the Peloponnesian War. The Spartans marched on Athens, savagely laying waste to the countryside all around. They uprooted all the olive trees, and this was a terrible misfortune, because it takes years for a newly planted olive tree to bear fruit. The Athenians hit back, attacking the Spartan colonies to the south of Italy at Syracuse in Sicily. There was a great deal of fighting and retaliation, a terrible plague in Athens in which Pericles died, and, in the end, Athens lost the war and the city walls were torn down. As is usually the case with wars, not only Athens but the whole country was exhausted by the conflict, and the victors were no exception. To add to it all, a small tribe near Delphi, provoked by the priests of the oracle, invaded and plundered the sanctuary of Apollo. Utter confusion followed. A foreign tribe, though not so very foreign, took advantage of this confusion to interfere. These were the Macedonians, a people who lived in the mountains to the north of Greece. The Macedonians were related to the Greeks, but they were barbarous and warlike. Their king, Philip, was a man of great cunning. He spoke excellent Greek and was familiar with Greek customs and culture, and his aim was to be king of all Greece. Since the invasion of the sanctuary at Delphi concerned all tribes loyal to the Greek religion, he had a good excuse to intervene. There was a politician in Athens, however, who was suspicious of Philip of Macedon. This was the famous orator Demosthenes, whose fulminating speeches at the assembly, in which he repeatedly warned people against King Philip's schemes, are known as Philippics. But Greece was too divided to put up any real defence. At Chaeronea in 338 BC, the Greeks, who hardly 100 years before had held their own against the gigantic Persian host, were defeated by King Philip and tiny Macedonia. So ended the freedom of the Greeks. Not that it could be said that they had made good use of it lately. But it wasn't Philip's intention to enslave or plunder Greece. He had other ideas. He planned to create a great army made up of Greeks and Macedonians with which to invade and conquer Persia. At the time of the Persian Wars, such a task would have proved impossible, but things had changed. The great kings of Persia were no longer able and ambitious like Darius or mighty like Xerxes. They had long given up ruling the country themselves, and contented themselves with the money their satraps sent back from the provinces. They used it to build themselves magnificent palaces, and held court in great style. They ate off golden dishes, and even their slaves, both male and female, were dressed in splendid robes. They loved good food, and good wines even more. So did their satraps. A kingdom like this, thought King Philip, should be easy to conquer. but before he had even contemplated the preparations for his campaign, he was assassinated. His son, who now inherited the whole of Greece along with his native Macedonia, was barely 20 years old at the time. His name was Alexander. The Greeks were convinced that freedom was in their grasp. He was only a boy, and they'd make short work of him. But Alexander was no ordinary boy. From his youth he had been impatient to be king. When he was little, he was said to cry whenever his father, King Philip, conquered another Greek city, saying, "Father won't leave anything for me to conquer when I'm king." Now his father had left him everything. A Greek city that tried to free itself was razed, and its inhabitants sold into slavery as a warning to all. Then Alexander summoned all the Greek leaders to a meeting in the town of Corinth to discuss the Persian campaign. Now Alexander wasn't just a brave and ambitious warrior. There was much more to him than that. He was exceptionally handsome, with long, curly hair, and he knew just about everything there was to know at the time. His tutor was the most famous teacher living, the Greek philosopher Aristotle. And if I tell you that Aristotle wasn't just Alexander's tutor, but, in a manner of speaking, the teacher of mankind for 2,000 years, you'll have an idea of what I mean. In the 2,000 years that followed, whenever people failed to agree on one thing or another, they turned to his writings. He was their referee. What Aristotle said must be right. For what he had done was to gather together all the knowledge of his time. He wrote about the natural sciences, the stars, animals and plants, about history and people living together in a state, what we call politics, about the right way to reason, logic, and the right way to behave, ethics. He wrote about poetry and its beauty. And last of all, he wrote down his own thoughts on a God who hovered impassive and unseen above the vault of heaven. All this Alexander studied too, and no doubt he was a good student. Best of all, he loved the stories about heroes in Homer's great lyric poems. They say he kept them under his pillow at night. But Alexander didn't spend all his time with his nose in a book. He loved sport and riding more than anything. No one rode better than he. His father once bought a beautiful stallion that no one could tame. His name was Bucephalus. Whenever anyone tried to mount him, they were thrown off. But Alexander worked out why he did it. The horse was afraid of his own shadow. So Alexander turned the horse's head towards the sun so that he couldn't see his shadow on the ground. Stroking him gently, he swung himself onto his back and rode round to the applause of the whole court. From that time on, Bucephalus would always be his favourite horse. Now, when Alexander appeared before the Greek leaders in Corinth, they greeted him warmly and paid him lavish compliments. All of them, that is, but one. A funny fellow, a philosopher named Diogenes. He had views not unlike those of the Buddha. According to him, possessions and all the things we think we need only serve to distract us and get in the way of our simple enjoyment of life. So he had given away everything he owned, and now sat, almost naked, in a barrel in the market square in Corinth, where he lived, as free and independent as a stray dog. Curious to meet this strange fellow, Alexander went to call on him. Dressed in shining armour, the plume on his helmet waving in the breeze, he walked up to the barrel and said to Diogenes, "I like you. Let me know your wish, and I shall grant it." Diogenes, who had until then been comfortably sunning himself, replied, "Indeed, sire, I have a wish." "Well, what is it?" "Your shadow has fallen over me. Stand a little less between me and the sun." Alexander is said to have been so struck by this that he said, "If I weren't Alexander, I should like to be Diogenes." A king like this was soon as popular with the Greek soldiers as he was with the Macedonians. They were more than willing to fight for him. So, with increasing confidence, Alexander marched on Persia. He gave everything he owned to his friends. They were horrified and said, "But what are you leaving for yourself?" "Hope," he is said to have replied. And that hope didn't deceive him. His army reached Asia Minor first. There he came up against the first Persian army. Although larger than his own, it turned out to be no more than a milling host of soldiers with no effective leader. The Persians were quickly put to flight, for Alexander's army fought bravely, and Alexander most bravely of all in the heat of the fray. It so happens that vanquished Asia Minor is the scene of the famous story of the Gordian Knot. It went like this. In the city of Gordium there was a temple, and in it an old chariot whose shaft was held fast by a strap that was tightly and intricately knotted. Now it had been foretold that he who could untie the enchanted knot would become master of the world. Alexander wasted little time fiddling with a knot that was clearly far worse than the sort you get in your shoelace when you are in a hurry. He did something my mother never let me do. He took his sword and simply chopped it through. The story's meaning is twofold. Alexander would conquer the world in fulfillment of the ancient prophecy, and he would do it with the sword, as indeed he did. You might find it easier to follow the rest of this story of conquest if you take a look at a map of the Middle East. Alexander could have gone on to attack Persia directly, but rather than risk an attack from the rear by the Persian provinces of Phoenicia and Egypt, he chose to subdue them first. The Persians tried to block his way near a town called Issus, but Alexander crushed them. He plundered the magnificent royal tents and made off with the king's treasure. He captured the king's wife and sisters, too, and treated them with the utmost respect and courtesy. That was in 333 BC, an easy date to remember. Phoenicia was less easy to conquer. For 7 long months Alexander laid siege to the city of Tyre. Its destruction, when it came, was all the more brutal. Egypt was easier. Glad to be rid of the Persians, the Egyptians soon surrendered to Persia's foe. But Alexander was determined to be a true ruler of Egypt, the sort they were used to. He marched across the desert to a temple of the sun god, and had the priests proclaim him son of the sun, and therefore righteous pharaoh. Before he left Egypt to continue his campaign, he founded a new city by the sea and named it after himself, Alexandria. It is still there today, and was for a long time one of the richest and most powerful cities in the world. Only now did he march on Persia. In the meantime, the Persian king had assembled a huge army and was waiting for Alexander near ancient Nineveh, at a place called Gaugamela. He sent messengers ahead to meet Alexander and offered him half his kingdom and his daughter in marriage, if only he would agree not to fight. "If I were Alexander, I'd take it," said Alexander's friend Parmenios. "And so would I, if I were Parmenios," was Alexander's reply. Half the world wasn't enough for Alexander. With that, he defeated the last and greatest Persian army. The king of Persia fled into the mountains, where he was assassinated. Alexander punished the assassins. Now he was king of the whole of Persia. Greece, Egypt, Phoenicia, Palestine, Babylonia, Assyria, Asia Minor, and Persia, all these were now part of his empire. He set about putting it in order. His commands could now be said to reach all the way from the Nile to Samarkand. This would probably have been enough for you or me, but Alexander was far from satisfied. He wanted to rule over new, undiscovered lands. He longed to see the mysterious, far-off peoples merchants talked about when they came to Persia with rare goods from the east. Like Dionysus in the Greek legend, he wanted to ride in triumph to the sunburnished Indians of the east and there receive their tribute. So he spent little time in the Persian capital, and in 327 BC led his army on the most perilous adventures, over unknown and unexplored mountain passes and down along the valley of the Indus into India. But the Indians did not submit to him willingly. The hermits and penitents in the forests denounced the conquerors from the distant west in their sermons, and the soldiers of the warrior caste fought valiantly so that every city had to be besieged and conquered in its turn. Alexander himself was no less valiant, as is shown by his encounter with an Indian king. King Porus had lain in wait for him on a branch of the Indus River, with a mighty army of war elephants and foot soldiers. When Alexander reached the river, the king's army was positioned on the far bank, and Alexander and his soldiers had no choice but to cross the river in the face of the enemy host. His success was one of his greatest feats. Yet even more remarkable was his victory over that army in the stifling heat of India. Porus was brought before him in chains. "What do you want of me?" asked Alexander. only that you treat me as befits a king. And that is all? That is all, came the reply. There is no more to be said. Alexander was so impressed that he gave Porus back his kingdom. He himself wished to march on even further towards the east, to the even more mysterious and unknown peoples who lived in the valley of the river Ganges. But his soldiers had had enough. They didn't want to march on to the end of the world. They wanted to go home. Alexander begged and pleaded and threatened to go on alone. He shut himself up in his tent and refused to come out for 3 whole days. But in the end the soldiers had their way, and he was forced to turn back. But they did agree to one thing. They wouldn't go home by the same route. Of course, it would have been far the simplest thing to do, since those regions had already been conquered. But Alexander wanted new sites and new conquests. So they followed the Indus down as far as the sea. There he put part of his army onto ships and sent them home that way. He himself chose to endure new and terrible hardships as he marched with the rest of the army over pitiless desert wastes. Alexander bore all the privations his army endured, and took no more water and slept no more than the next man. He fought in the foremost ranks. On one occasion he only escaped death by a miracle. That day they were besieging a fortress. Ladders had been set in place to scale the walls. Alexander was first up. He had reached the top when the ladder snapped under the weight of the soldiers behind, leaving him alone on top of the wall. His men shouted to him to jump back down. Instead, he leapt straight into the city and, with his back to the ramparts, defended himself with his shield against overwhelming odds. By the time the others were able to scale the wall to rescue him, he had already been hit by an arrow. It must have been thrilling. In the end, they returned to the Persian capital. But since Alexander had burnt it down when he conquered it, he chose to set up his court in Babylon. This was no idle choice. Son of the sun to the Egyptians, king of kings to the Persians, with troops in India and in Athens, he was determined to show the world that he was its rightful ruler. It may not have been pride that prompted him to do so. As a pupil of Aristotle, he understood human nature and knew that power needs pomp and dignity if it wants to make the right impression. So he introduced all the age-old ceremonies of the Babylonian and Persian courts. Anyone who came into his presence had to fall on their knees before him and speak to him as if he were a god. And, in the manner of Oriental kings, he had several wives, among them the daughter of the Persian king Darius, which made him that king's rightful successor. For Alexander didn't wish to be seen as a foreign conqueror. His aim was to combine the wisdom and splendor of the East with the clear thinking and vitality of the Greeks, and so create something entirely new and wonderful. But this idea didn't please the Greeks and Macedonians at all. They were the conquerors, so they should be the masters. What was more, they were free men and used to their freedom. They weren't going to bow down to any man on earth, or, as they put it, lick any man's boots. His Greek friends and the soldiers became increasingly rebellious, and he was forced to send them home. Alexander never realized his great ambition of mingling the two peoples, even though he handed out rich dowries to 10,000 Macedonian and Greek soldiers so that they could marry Persian women, and laid on a great wedding feast for all. He had great plans. He wanted to found many more cities like Alexandria. He wanted to build roads and change the face of the world with his military campaigns, whether the Greeks liked it or not. Just imagine, in those days, to have a regular postal service running from India to Athens. But in the midst of all his plans, he died, in Nebuchadnezzar's summer palace in 323 BC. He was 32 years old, an age when most people's lives have barely begun. To the question of who should succeed him, he answered, in his fever, "He who is most worthy." But there was no one. The generals and princes in his entourage were greedy, dissolute, and dishonest. They fought over the empire until it fell apart. Egypt was then governed by a family of generals, the Ptolemies. The Seleucids ruled Mesopotamia, and the Attalids Asia Minor. India was simply abandoned. But although the empire was in pieces, Alexander's grand project slowly went on taking shape. Greek art and the spirit of Greece had penetrated Persia and passed on through India to China. Meanwhile, the Greeks themselves had learnt that there was more to the world than Athens and Sparta, and more to do than waste their lives in endless squabbling between Dorians and Ionians. And, having lost the little political power they once had, the Greeks went on to be the bearers of the greatest intellectual force there has ever been, the force we know as Greek culture. This force was protected and preserved in some very special fortresses. Can you guess what those fortresses were? They were libraries. Alexandria, for instance, had a Greek library that held around 700,000 scrolls. Those 700,000 scrolls were the Greek soldiers who set off to conquer the world. And that empire is still standing today. Chapter 13. New Wars and New Warriors. Alexander only went east, although only may not be quite the right word. But the lands that lay to the west of Greece did not tempt him. Just a couple of Phoenician and Greek colonies, and a handful of densely wooded peninsulas inhabited by tribes of stubborn and unruly peasants. One of these peninsulas was Italy, and one of the peasant tribes, the Romans. At the time of Alexander the Great, the Roman Empire was no more than a little patch of land in the heart of Italy, and Rome a tiny city of twisting streets within strong walls. But Rome's inhabitants were a proud people. They loved recounting stories of the greatness of their past, and were convinced of a great future. Their history, as they told it, went back to ancient Troy. A Trojan named Aeneas fled to Italy. His descendants were the twin brothers Romulus and Remus, sons of Mars, the god of war, who were suckled and raised in the forest by a wild she-wolf. Romulus, so the myth goes, founded Rome. They even had a date for it, 753 BC, and would later count the years from that date as the Greeks did from the Olympiads. They would say, in such and such a year after the city's founding. So, for example, the Roman year 100 is what we would call the 653rd year before the birth of Christ, or 653 BC. The Romans had lots of other stories about the glorious past of their little city. Tales of kings, both good and bad, and their wars with neighbouring cities. I almost said with neighbouring villages. The seventh and last king was called Tarquin the Proud, and he was said to have been assassinated by a nobleman named Brutus. From that time onwards, power was in the hands of the nobility. These were the patricians. The word means something like city fathers. Although in those days they weren't citizens as we know them, but old land-owning families with vast estates of fields and meadows. And they alone had the right to choose officials to govern the city once there were no more kings. In Rome, the highest officials were the consuls. There were always two of them ruling jointly, and they held office for just 1 year. Then they had to stand down. Of course, the patricians weren't the only people who lived in the city. But if you didn't have illustrious ancestors or great estates, you weren't noble. The others were the plebeians, and they were almost a caste of their own, as in India. A plebeian couldn't marry a patrician, still less could he become a consul. He wasn't even allowed to voice his opinion at the people's assembly on the field of Mars, outside the city gates. But the plebeians were many, and every inch as strong-willed and stubborn as the patricians. Unlike the gentle Indians, they didn't willingly submit. On more than one occasion, they threatened to leave the city unless they were treated better and given a share of the fields and pastures which the patricians liked to keep for themselves. After a relentless struggle which went on for more than 100 years, the plebeians of Rome finally succeeded in obtaining the same rights as the patricians. Of the two consuls, one would be a patrician, the other a plebeian. So justice was done. The end of this long and complicated struggle coincided with the time of Alexander the Great. From this struggle you will have gained some idea of what the Romans were like. They were not as quick-thinking or as inventive as the Athenians, nor did they take such delight in beautiful things, in buildings, statues, and poetry. Nor was reflecting on the world and on life so vital to them. But when they set out to do something, they did it. Even if it took 200 years, for they were peasants through and through, not restless seafarers like the Athenians. Their homes, their livestock, and their land, these were what mattered. They cared little for travel. They founded no colonies. They loved their native city and its soil, and would do anything and everything to increase its prosperity and power. They would fight for it, and they would die for it. Beside their native soil, there was one other thing that was important to them: their law. Not the law that is just and fair, and before which all men are equal, but the law which is law, the law that is laid down. Their laws were inscribed on 12 bronze tablets set out in the marketplace, and those few stern words meant precisely what they said: no exceptions, no compassion, no mercy. For these were the laws of their ancestors, and they must be right. There are many old and wonderful stories telling of the love Romans had for their native land and of their faithfulness to its laws. Stories of fathers who sentenced their own sons to death without turning a hair because the law so demanded, and of heroes who didn't hesitate to give their lives for their fellow countrymen on the battlefield or in captivity. While we don't have to believe every word of them, such stories give us an idea of what was expected of a Roman: the harshness and discipline that it was his duty to show towards himself and to others whenever his native land or the law were involved. Nothing could shake these Romans. They never gave up, not even when their city was captured and burnt to the ground by tribesmen from the north called Gauls in 390 BC. They just rebuilt it, fortified it, and gradually brought the small surrounding towns back under their control. After the time of Alexander the Great, however, small wars against small towns ceased to satisfy them, and they set about conquering the entire peninsula. Not, as Alexander had done, in one single great campaign, but in easy stages, town by town, region by region, and with all their characteristic single-mindedness and determination. It usually went like this. Because Rome was a powerful city, other Italian cities wanted to be its allies. This suited the Romans very well, and all would go smoothly as long as the allies behaved themselves. But if a disagreement arose that led to an ally's refusing to follow Rome's instructions, it would mean war, a war which Rome's regiments or legions usually won. Now it so happened that one day a city in the south of Italy asked a Greek prince and commander called Pyrrhus to come to its aid against Rome. He arrived with war elephants, whose use the Greeks had learnt from the Indians, and succeeded in defeating the Roman legions, but at a cost. He lost so many of his men that he is said to have cried out, "One more such victory and we are lost," which is why people still speak of a Pyrrhic victory, if it has been won at too great a cost. Pyrrhus soon withdrew his forces, leaving the Romans to become lords of the whole of southern Italy. But even that was not enough for them. They aimed to conquer Sicily as well, drawn by the island's fertile soil, which produced such good crops, and by its wealthy Greek colonies. But Sicily didn't belong to the Greeks anymore. It was under the control of the Phoenicians. Now, as you remember, even before the Greeks, the Phoenicians had set up trading posts and founded cities everywhere they went. These were mainly in southern Spain and along the coasts of North Africa. One of the African cities was Carthage, and it lay immediately opposite Sicily. Carthage was the richest and mightiest city for miles around, and the Romans referred to its Phoenician inhabitants as Punics. Its ships went far across the seas, taking goods from one country to another, and, since they were so near Sicily, they fetched grain from there. Because of this, the Carthaginians had become Rome's first real opponents, and very dangerous ones, too. Unlike the Romans, they didn't usually fight themselves, but could afford to pay foreign mercenaries to fight on their behalf. In the war which now broke out in Sicily, they won the early battles, not least because the Romans didn't have many ships, weren't used to sea voyages and sea warfare, and knew next to nothing about shipbuilding. But one day a Carthaginian ship ran aground off Italy. Using it as a model and working in furious haste, the Romans managed to build a whole fleet of identical ships within 2 months. It took all the money they had, but with their brand new fleet they defeated the Carthaginians, who were soon forced to cede Sicily to the Romans. This happened in 241 BC. However, It was only the start of the war between the two cities. "They've taken Sicily," the Carthaginians said to themselves, "so we'll take Spain." Now, at the time we're talking about, there weren't any Romans in Spain, only wild tribes. Even so, the Romans would not allow it. It so happened that there was a Carthaginian commander in Spain whose son Hannibal was a truly extraordinary young man. Reared among soldiers, he knew everything there was to know about warfare. Hunger and cold, heat and thirst, forced marches, night and day, he had seen them all. He was fearless, unbelievably tenacious, and a born leader. He could outwit the enemy with his cunning and sum up a situation in an instant, and he had a cool head. He was that rare thing, a man who made war like a chess player, carefully considering each move before he made it. But above all, he was a good Carthaginian. He already hated the Romans for trying to subdue his native city, and their meddling in Spain was the last straw. He left Spain immediately for Italy, equipped with war elephants and a large army, a truly formidable force. To reach Italy, he had to take his army and all his elephants across the whole of southern France, across rivers and over mountains, and right up over the Alps. He may have taken the pass that goes over the shoulder of Mount Cenis, as it is known today. I've been there myself, following a wide, winding road. But how they found their way over those wild mountains in those days, with no roads to follow, is impossible to imagine. Surrounded by deep ravines, sheer precipices, and slippery grass ledges, I wouldn't want to be up there with one elephant, let alone 40, and by then it was already September, and there was snow on the mountaintops. But Hannibal found a way through for his army, and they finally reached Italy. There he was confronted by the Romans, but he defeated them in a bloody battle. Later, a second Roman army surprised his camp under cover of darkness. But Hannibal, having been forewarned, saved himself with a cunning trick. He tied flaming torches to the horns of a herd of cattle and drove them down the mountainside where his camp was billeted. In the darkness, the Roman soldiers mistook them for Hannibal's soldiers and rushed off in hot pursuit. How I would love to have seen their faces when they finally caught up with them and found they were cows. The Romans had a very gifted general called Quintus Fabius Maximus, who wanted to avoid meeting Hannibal in battle. He believed that Hannibal would eventually become impatient and, being in a foreign country, was bound to make a blunder. But the Romans didn't like his waiting game and mocked Quintus Fabius Maximus, calling him cunctator, hesitator. Ignoring his advice, they attacked Hannibal at a place called Cannae. There they were decisively beaten, 40,000 dead on the Roman side. This battle, which took place in 217 BC, was their bloodiest defeat. Yet despite his victory, Hannibal did not march on Rome. Favoring caution, he stayed put and waited for reinforcements from home. And this was his undoing, for Carthage sent no fresh troops, and his men began to run wild, robbing and plundering the Italian cities. Though the Romans no longer dared attack him directly, they called up all their men to fight. Every one of them, even young boys and slaves. Every man in Italy became a soldier. And these weren't hired soldiers like Hannibal's, they were Romans, and you know what that means. They fought the Carthaginians both in Sicily and in Spain. And everywhere they fought, as long as it wasn't Hannibal they were fighting, they always won. After 14 years in Italy, Hannibal finally returned to Africa, where his countrymen needed him. The Romans, led by Scipio, their general, had reached the gates of Carthage, and there Hannibal met his defeat. In 202 BC, the Romans conquered Carthage. The Carthaginians were made to burn their entire fleet and pay the Romans a huge sum of money. Hannibal fled and later poisoned himself rather than fall into the hands of the Romans. Emboldened by its great victory, Rome now conquered Greece, still under Macedonian rule, and as disunited and fragmented as ever. They brought home the most beautiful works of art from Corinth and reduced the city to ashes. Rome also expanded northwards into the land of the Gauls, who, 200 years earlier, had sacked Rome. They conquered the region we know as northern Italy, yet even this was not enough. Carthage was still standing, a fact which many Romans would not accept, in particular a patrician named Cato. Cato was a just and honourable man, but notoriously severe. Whenever the city council met at the Senate, no matter what was discussed, he is said to have ended every speech with the words, "For the rest, I propose that Carthage be destroyed." And in the end, that is precisely what they did. The Romans invented a pretext to attack. The Carthaginians defended themselves desperately, and even after the city had fallen, the Roman soldiers had to fight on, house by house, through the streets for 6 more days. When the city was finally conquered, every Carthaginian had either been killed or captured. The Romans razed all the houses and turned the land where Carthage had once stood into a plain. It was 146 BC, and that was the end of Hannibal's city. Now Rome was the mightiest city in the world. Chapter 14. An Enemy of History. If you have always found history boring, you are going to enjoy this chapter. At about the same time as Hannibal was in Italy, that is, shortly after 220 BC, an emperor was ruling over China who hated history so much that, in 213 BC, he ordered all history books and all old reports and records to be burnt, along with all collections of songs and poems and the writings of Confucius and Lao Tzu. In fact, everything he considered to be useless rubbish. The only books he permitted were ones on agriculture and other useful subjects. Anybody found in possession of any other sort of book was to be put to death. This emperor was Shi Huangdi, the first emperor of all China, and one of the greatest warriors there has ever been. He was not born into an imperial family, but was the son of one of the princes I told you about, who ruled the many Chinese provinces. His province was called Qin, from which his family took its name, and it is likely that the whole country now known as China was named after him. There are certainly more than enough reasons for China to take its name from the Prince of Qin. Not only did he make himself the first emperor of all China by conquering all the other provinces one by one, but he transformed the entire country. He threw out all the princes and totally reorganized his empire. And if you ask me why he hated history and destroyed all those books, it was because he wanted to wipe out every trace of how things had been done before, so he could build an entirely new China, his China, starting from scratch. He built roads everywhere and began work on an enormous project, the Great Wall of China. Today it is still a massive construction, a double wall made of stone with tall towers and castellations winding its symmetrical way over plains, through deep ravines and up steep mountain slopes as it follows the line of the frontier for all of 4,000 miles. Shi Huangdi built it to protect China's many hard-working and peaceable peasants and townspeople from the wild tribes of the steppes, whose warlike horsemen roamed the vast plains of Inner Asia. It had to be strong enough to resist their incessant raids with all their looting and killing. And he succeeded. Of course, over the centuries the wall has often been rebuilt and strengthened, but it is still there today. Shi Huangdi didn't have a long reign. Soon a new family ascended the throne of the Son of Heaven. This was the Han family. They saw no need to undo all Shi Huangdi's good works, and under their rule China remained strong and unified. But by now the Hans were no longer enemies of history. On the contrary, they remembered China's debt to the teachings of Confucius, and set about searching high and low for all those ancient writings. It turned out that many people had had the courage not to burn them after all. Now they were carefully collected and valued twice as highly as before. And to become a government official, you had to know them all. China is, in fact, the only country in the world to be ruled for hundreds of years not by the nobility, nor by soldiers, nor even by the priesthood, but by scholars. No matter where you came from or whether you were rich or poor, as long as you gained high marks in your exams, you could become an official. The highest post went to the person with the highest marks. But the exams were far from easy. You had to be able to write thousands of characters, and you can imagine how hard that is. What is more, you had to know an enormous number of ancient books, and all the rules and teachings of Confucius and the other ancient sages off by heart. So Shi Huangdi's burning of the books was all in vain, and if you thought he was right, you were mistaken. It's a bad idea to try to prevent people from knowing their own history. If you want to do anything new, you must first make sure you know what people have tried before. Chapter 15. Rulers of the Western World. It would never have occurred to the Romans to do what Alexander the Great had done. They had no wish to turn the lands they conquered into a single, vast empire in which everyone was treated equally. Certainly not. All the lands the Roman legions conquered, and their conquests came thick and fast, became Roman provinces, their towns occupied by Roman troops and Roman officials. These occupiers looked down on the native inhabitants, even when they were Phoenicians, Jews, and Greeks, all peoples of very ancient culture. In the eyes of the Romans, they were good for just one thing, paying up. They were subject to crushing taxes and had to keep sending grain to Rome, as much and as often as possible. Provided they did so, they were left more or less in peace. They could practice their own religion and speak their own language, and in many ways they benefited from all the good things the Romans brought, such as roads. Many of these, splendidly paved, led out from Rome across the plains and over distant mountain passes to remote and inaccessible parts of the empire. It must be said that the Romans didn't build these roads out of consideration for the people living there. On the contrary, their aim was to send news and troops to all parts of the empire in the shortest possible time. The Romans were superb engineers. Most impressive of all their works were their magnificent aqueducts. These brought water from distant mountains and carried it down through valleys and into the towns, clear, fresh water to fill innumerable fountains and bathhouses, so that Rome's provincial officials could enjoy all the comforts they were used to having at home. A Roman citizen living abroad always retained his separate status, for he lived according to Roman law. Wherever he happened to be in that vast empire, he could turn to a Roman official and say, "I am a citizen of Rome." These words had the effect of a magic formula. If until then no one had paid him much attention, everyone would instantly become polite and obliging. In those days, however, the true rulers of the world were the Roman soldiers. It was they who held the gigantic empire together, suppressing revolts where necessary, and ferociously punishing all who dared oppose them. Courageous, experienced, and ambitious, they conquered a new land, to the north, to the south, or to the east, almost every decade. People who saw the tight columns of well-drilled soldiers marching slowly in their metal-plated tunics, with their shields and javelins, their slings and swords, and their catapults for hurling rocks and arrows, knew that it was useless to resist. War was their favorite pastime. After each victory they returned in triumph to Rome, led by their generals, with all their captives and their loot. To the sound of trumpets they would march past the cheering crowds through gates of honor and triumphal arches. Above their heads they held pictures and placards, like billboards, to advertise their victories. The general would stand tall in his chariot, a crown of laurel on his head, and wearing the sacred cape worn by the statue of Jupiter, god of gods, in his temple. Like a second Jupiter, he would climb the steep path to the capital, the citadel of Rome. And there in the temple, high above the city, he would make his solemn sacrifice of thanksgiving to God, while below him the leaders of the vanquished were put to death. A general who had many such victories, with plenty of booty for his troops and land for them to cultivate when they grew old and were retired from service, was loved by his men like a father. They would give their all for him, not just on foreign soil, but at home as well. For, in their eyes, a great hero of the battlefield was just what was needed to keep order at home, where there was often trouble brewing. For Rome had become a huge city, with large numbers of destitute people who had no work and no money. If the provinces failed to send grain, it meant famine in Rome. Two brothers, living in about 130 BC, that is, 16 years after the destruction of Carthage, thought up a plan to encourage this multitude of poor and starving people to move to Africa and settle there as farmers. These brothers were the Gracchi, but they were both killed in the course of political struggles. The same blind devotion that the soldiers gave their general went to any man who gave grain to the multitudes and put on splendid festivals. For Romans loved festivals. But these were not at all like those of the Greeks, where leading citizens took part in sporting contests and sang hymns in honor of the father of the gods. These would have seemed ridiculous to any Roman. What serious, self-respecting man would sing in public, or take off his formal, many-pleated toga to throw javelins before an audience? Such things were best left to captives. It was they who had to wrestle and fight, confront wild beasts, and stage whole battles in the arena under the eyes of thousands, sometimes tens of thousands, of spectators. It all got very serious and bloody, but that was just what made it so exciting for the Romans, especially when, instead of trained professionals, men who had been condemned to death were thrown into the arena to grapple with lions, bears, tigers, and even elephants. Anyone who put on shows like these, with generous handouts of grain, was loved by the crowd and could do what he pleased. As you can imagine, many tried. If two rivals fought for power, one might have the army and the patricians on his side, while the other had the support of the plebeians and poor peasants. And in a long, drawn-out struggle, now one and now the other would be uppermost. There were two such famous enemies called Marius and Sulla. Marius had been fighting in Africa and, several years later, took his army to rescue the Roman Empire when it was in peril. In 113 BC, barbarians from the north had invaded Italy, as the Dorians had Greece, or, 700 years later, the Gauls had Rome. These invaders were the Cimbri and the Teutons, ancestors of today's Germans. They had fought so bravely that they had actually succeeded in putting the Roman legions to flight. But Marius and his army had been able to halt and defeat them. This made him the most celebrated man in Rome. But in the meantime, Sulla had fought on in Africa, and he too had returned triumphant. Both men got ready to fight it out. Marius had all Sulla's friends killed. Sulla, in his turn, made a long list of the Romans who supported Marius and had them murdered. He then generously presented all their property to the state, after which he and his soldiers ruled the Roman Empire till 79 BC. In the course of these turbulent times, Romans had changed a great deal. All the peasants had gone. A handful of rich people had bought up the smaller farms and brought in slaves to run their vast estates. Romans had, in fact, grown used to leaving everything to be managed by slaves. Not only those who worked in the mines and quarries, but even the tutors of patrician children were mostly slaves, prisoners of war or their descendants. They were treated as goods, bought and sold like cattle. Slave owners could do what they liked with their slaves, even kill them. Slaves had no rights at all. Some masters sold them to fight with wild beasts in the arena, where they were known as gladiators. On one occasion, the gladiators rebelled against this treatment. They were urged on by a slave called Spartacus, and many slaves from the country estates rallied to him. They fought with a ferocity born of desperation, and the Romans were hard put to suppress the revolt, for which the slaves paid a terrible price. That was in 71 BC. By this time, new generals had become the darlings of the Roman populace. The most popular of them all was Gaius Julius Caesar. He, too, knew how to win the hearts of the masses, and had raised colossal sums of money for magnificent festivals and gifts of grain. But more than that, he was a truly great general, one of the greatest there has ever been. One day he went to war. A few days later, Rome received a letter from him with just these three Latin words, Veni, Vidi, Vici, meaning, I came, I saw, I conquered. That is how fast he worked. He conquered France, in those days known as Gaul, and made it a province of Rome. This was no small feat, for the peoples who lived there were exceptionally brave and warlike, and not easily intimidated. The conquest took 7 years, from 58 to 51 BC. He fought against the Helvetii, who lived in what is now Switzerland, the Gauls, and the Germans. Twice he crossed the Rhine into land that is now part of Germany, and twice he crossed the sea to England, known to the Romans as Britannia. He did this to teach neighboring tribes a proper fear and respect for Rome. Although the Gauls continued to fight desperately for years on end, he attacked them repeatedly, and everywhere he went he left troops in control behind him. Once Gaul had become a Roman province, the inhabitants soon learnt to speak Latin, just as they had in Spain. And this is why French and Spanish, which come from the language of the Romans, are known as Romance languages. After the conquest of Gaul, Caesar turned his army towards Italy. He was now the most powerful man in the world. Other generals who had previously been his allies he attacked and defeated. And after he had seduced Cleopatra, the beautiful queen of Egypt, he was able to add Egypt to the Roman Empire. Then he set about putting it in order. For this he was ideally suited, for he had an exceptionally orderly mind. He was able to dictate two letters at the same time without getting his thoughts in a tangle. Imagine that. He didn't just put the whole empire in order, he put time in order too. He put time in order? Whatever does that mean? He reformed the calendar so that it ended up being more or less like ours, with 12 months and leap years. It is called after him, the Julian calendar. And, because he was such a great man, one of the months is also named after him, the month of July. So July takes its name from a thin-faced, bald-headed man who liked to wear a laurel wreath made of gold on his head, a man whose weak and sickly body hid a shining intellect and a will of iron. Since Caesar was now the mightiest man on earth, he could have become king of the Roman Empire, and he might not have objected to that. But the Romans were jealous of him, even his best friend Brutus, and they didn't want to be ruled by him. Fearing that Caesar would get the better of them, they decided to murder him. During a meeting in the Senate, they surrounded him and raised their daggers to stab him. Caesar defended himself, but when, among his assailants, he caught sight of Brutus, he is reported to have said, "You too, Brutus, my son," and then let them strike him down, without making any further attempts to resist. This happened in 44 BC. After July comes August. Caesar Octavianus Augustus was Caesar's adoptive son. Having fought for a long time against a number of generals on land and at sea, he finally succeeded in becoming the sole ruler of the empire in 31 BC, and so became the first to hold the title of Roman Emperor. Since 1 month had been named after Julius Caesar, Augustus was given one too. He had certainly earned it. He may not have been extraordinary like Caesar, but he was a fair and prudent man who controlled himself at all times, and so had earned the right to control others. It is said that he never gave an order or made a decision in anger. Whenever he felt his temper rising, he slowly recited the alphabet in his head, and by the time he had reached the end, he had calmed down. This tells you what he was like, cool-headed, a man who ruled the empire fairly and wisely. He wasn't only a warrior, and he didn't only enjoy going to gladiator fights. He lived simply, and appreciated fine sculpture and fine poetry. And because the Romans were less gifted than the Greeks at such things, he had copies made of all the finest Greek statues and placed them in his palaces and gardens. The Roman poets of his time, and they are the most famous of all the Roman poets, also took the poems of the Greeks as their models. For even in those days, people thought that all the most beautiful things came from Greece. And, for the same reason, it was considered a sign of distinction for a Roman to speak Greek, to read the ancient Greek poets, and to collect Greek works of art. This was lucky for us, for if they hadn't, we might never have heard about any of it. Chapter 16. The Good News. Augustus ruled from 31 BC until AD 14, which tells you that Jesus Christ was born during his reign. He was born in Palestine, which was then a Roman province. You can read about the life and teachings of Jesus Christ in the Bible. You probably know the essentials of what he taught, that it doesn't matter if a person is rich or poor, of noble or of humble birth, a master or a slave, a great thinker or a child, that all men are God's children, and that the love of this Father is infinite, that before him no man is without sin, but that God has pity on sinners, that what matters is not judgment, but mercy. You know what mercy is, the great giving and forgiving love of God, and that we should treat others as we hope God our Father will treat us. That is why Jesus said, "Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, do not stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back." And you know that Jesus spent just a short time traveling all over the country, preaching and teaching, healing the sick and comforting the poor. That he was accused of wanting to be king of the Jews, and that, as a rebellious Jew, he was sentenced by a Roman official called Pontius Pilate to be nailed to a cross. This terrible punishment was only given to slaves, robbers, and members of subject peoples, not to citizens of Rome. It was also seen as a dreadful humiliation. But Christ had taught that the world's worst sorrows had a meaning, that beggars, those in torment, the persecuted, the sick, and the suffering were blessed in their misfortune. And so it was that the Son of God, martyred and in agony, became for the first Christians the very symbol of his teaching. Today we can hardly imagine what that meant. The cross was even worse than the gallows. And this cross of shame became the symbol of the new teaching. Just imagine what a Roman official or soldier or a Roman teacher steeped in Greek culture, proud of his wisdom, his rhetoric, and his knowledge of philosophy, would have thought when he heard Christ's teaching from one of the great preachers, perhaps the Apostle Paul in Athens or in Rome. We can read what he preached there today in his first letter to the Corinthians. "I will show you a more excellent way. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am but a sounding gong or a tinkling cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy, and can see into all mysteries, and have all knowledge, and have all faith, so that I can move mountains, but have not love, then I am nothing. If I give away everything that is mine, and offer up my body to be burnt, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is long-suffering and kind. Love does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it does not behave improperly. It does not seek its own advantage. It is not easily provoked. It bears no grudge, delights not in evil, but rejoices only in the truth. It shelters all, trusts all, always hopes, always endures. Love is everlasting." When they heard Paul's sermons, the Roman patricians must have shaken their heads in disapproval, for this was hardly the language of the law. But the poor and downtrodden heard in Paul's words something that was entirely new, something that had never been heard before. The extraordinary announcement of divine grace, which was far greater than any law, and was called the gospel, or the good news. Good news, or glad tidings, is a translation of the Greek evangelion, from which we get the word evangelical. And this good and happy news of the mercy of God the Father, the unique and invisible God in whom the Jews had believed long before Christ had lived and preached among them, soon spread throughout the Roman Empire. Roman officials began to pay attention. As you know, they hadn't previously involved themselves in matters of religion. But this was something new. The Christians, who believed in just one God, were refusing to scatter incense before images of the emperor, which had been the custom since Rome had had an emperor. Like the rulers of the Egyptians, the Chinese, the Babylonians, and the Persians, Roman emperors allowed themselves to be worshipped as gods. Their statues were everywhere, and every good citizen was expected to place a few perfumed grains in front of these images as an offering. But the Christians were refusing to do so, and people wanted to make them. Now, about 30 years after Christ's death on the cross, that is, around 60 years after his birth, in A.D. 60, a cruel emperor was ruling over the Roman Empire. He was called Nero. People still shudder when they hear the name of this monster, but what is truly repellent about him is that he didn't start out as a monster, ruthless and wicked through and through. He was simply weak, vain, suspicious, and lazy. Nero fancied himself as a poet and composed songs which he performed himself. He ate, or rather gorged himself, on the rarest delicacies, and was utterly devoid of decency or dignity. He was not unattractive, but there was something cruel and self-satisfied about his smile. He had his own mother murdered, and his wife and his tutor, along with a number of other relations and friends. He lived in constant fear of assassination, for he was a coward too. One day a terrible fire broke out in Rome, which, burning day and night, consumed house after house, district after district, and made hundreds of thousands of people homeless. For by then Rome was a huge city with more than 1 million inhabitants. And what do you think Nero did? He stood on the balcony of his sumptuous palace with his lyre and sang a song he had composed about the burning of Troy. To him this seemed perfect for the occasion. The people, however, were enraged. Until then they had not hated him much because he had always given them splendid festivals and had only been cruel to close friends and acquaintances. Now the rumor spread that Nero himself had set Rome on fire. We do not know if it is true, but in any case Nero knew that people thought he was responsible. So he looked around for a scapegoat and found one in the Christians. The Christians had often said that this world must end so that a better, purer world might take its place. Of course, you and I know that they meant heaven, but because people tend not to listen very carefully, soon they were saying, "The Christians want the world to end because they hate mankind." An extraordinary accusation, don't you think? Nero had them arrested wherever he found them, and they were brutally put to death. Some were torn to pieces by wild beasts in the arena, while others were burnt alive as torches at a grand nocturnal banquet in his garden. But the Christians bore all these tortures and those of later persecutions with unbelievable